Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 21, 16th Hole. Ellie panned her camera down the 16th fairway and zoomed in on the sand trap guarding the left half of the green. "It's a fairly short par 4," she told Jason, "but they definitely want their first shot to be on the right side of the fairway. It opens up about halfway down, and with this hole being downhill, it should be fairly easy to par. If I know Patterson, though, he's going for the birdie."
"Because he's tied?"
Jason asked off-air. "No, because of the green. It's fairly flat, and if he gets a good chip shot, which we know he usually does, he can get it within a few yards of the hole."
"And Hanover?"
Jason asked. "We'll have to wait and see. His approach tends to be inconsistent at best."
"Listen, we have about 50 markets on now. We're pretty much national. And the station says we're getting tons of calls asking what this tournament is about and why they don't know who these two guys are."
"Aren't you telling them on the air?"
"With people tuning in all the time, it's hard to keep them all up to speed. But I am getting a lot of comments on my commentary."
"Good comments?" Ellie had a little caution in her voice.
"Of course. Mainly thanks to you and Freddie."
"That statistics geek back at the station?"
"You know him?"
"Yeah, he knows his stuff."
"Well, I couldn't be doing it without you."
"And to think," Ellie pointed out, "you didn't even want to come here today. An hour or two when we were going to be back in the studio editing your 2.5 minutes of tape."
"I'll admit I misjudged the whole thing."
"Does that mean you'll be out golfing with my uncle soon?"
"Let's not push it."
"Only 3 more holes, and I don't have any idea how this is going to turn out."
"It's already turned out magnificent, Ellie. Keep up the good work."
"You too," she answered. She turned her camera to the tee. Scott Hanover would get to go first this time. He was still smiling from the last hole. Where had that putt come from, she wondered. It was amazing, especially with him closing his eyes. It was like he was in a trance. The tiny leaderboard held aloft on a pole by some kid now had Hanover listed in the top position, although both golfers were now 9 under par. That would irk Patterson. Kenny Chase sipped at his coffee. Hanover had gone and tied the score. If only the lucky amateur had the sense to drop another stroke or two, Kenny wouldn't have to look. He pulled the ball from his inside jacket pocket. It was still wrapped in the butcher paper and sealed with a bit of masking tape. "What's in the package?" asked the man standing in front of him.
"Nothing,"
Kenny said, a little too quickly. "Is that Hanover's ball?" he asked.
"Who are you?"
"Keith Kelly. I'm a producer with USA Sports. You want to tell me what you found?"
"I really don't."
Keith cut him off. "Don't lie, Mr. Chase. If you don't answer my questions, I'll be forced to speculate. You wouldn't want misinformation to get out, would you? I know you sent a diver to the water hazard on the 8th hole,
and he pulled out a ball with a duck logo printed on it. The same kind of ball Scott Hanover is using. The ball he hit into the hazard this morning. I know you just returned from doing some tests. I know you used to check balls for the PGA. Now, Mr. Chase, do you want to answer my question or not? Kenny didn't want to answer his question. But how in the world did he get all that information? He considered the options. If he went public with all he had, Bateman would fry him. If he answered Kelly, maybe he could get him to wait until he could tell Bateman himself the news. I haven't finished my analysis yet. You expect me to believe that? He plunked the halved ball onto the table. It's in there. I was about to do a visual inspection. The X-ray showed nothing obvious in terms of an illegal ball. You had the ball X-rayed? He asked. Where? At a veterinary clinic. Sometimes you can see a distinct inner core that is consistent with a doped illegal ball. The best test is to put the ball in the club machine. The club machine? It's a mechanical golfer. Hits any ball it tests with the same force so we can compare how far it goes. The PGA limits the distance allowed for balls when hit by the machine. Then how can you tell? I had the ball cut in half. I'll visually inspect the material inside. Most balls have distinctive layers or colors. The doped balls have a material inside that is almost like a super ball. You really haven't looked yet? No, answered Kenny. I thought that if Hanover wasn't close, it wouldn't matter. Well, it matters now, Keith added. Kenny slid the package toward himself and peeled the tape off. He unfolded the paper and looked at the two halves sitting side by side. He picked up the one without the duck logo and turned it over. The surprise on his face did not go unnoticed by Keith. What is it? He asked. Kenny pulled a pocket knife out of his pocket and unfolded a small blade, then dug at the material in the ball. I'll be, he muttered. Is it doped? Is Hanover using illegal balls? It can't be, he almost chuckled. What is it? Demanded Keith. He turned his attention to the other half and scraped lightly at the duck logo. The yellow flaked off in streaks as he scraped, and slowly the word Wilson was visible. A little more work and he revealed titanium. What's a titanium? Asked Keith. A perfectly legal ball. The guys put the logo over the brand name. I went to all that trouble, and all I had to do was scrape off one of those ducks. I'll be a monkey's uncle. But how is he doing so well? He's ranked last, for God's sake, moaned Keith. I guess he's just having a really good day. How are the contractions? Sally asked. Nothing bad, Sarah replied. Gina glanced at her watch. They are getting closer together. They're about 8 minutes now. We need to get you to a hospital, Sally said. I just think the kid wants to see its dad play, Sarah suggested. Well, with any luck, he or she will get to watch it on tape in a couple of weeks, hoped Gina. The three laughed. Sarah saw Scott look at her from the tee. His smile was bright and hopeful. She didn't know if he was hopeful of winning, but she knew he had won the hearts of a bunch of these people here. It was evident, even to Sarah, that Patterson was a much better golfer. But Scott had luck on his side, and he had her. If her presence could help, she'd be here, even if she did have to drop the kid on the 18th tee. Scott looked down the fairway. He'd remembered playing this hole and ending up in the sand just in front of the green. He tried to think how Andrew Patterson would hit. Most likely, he'd try to end up on the right side and approach the pin where there was an open spot in front of the green. If only he could be certain of where his ball was going, he'd do the same. If he aimed to the right and then added a little slice, he'd be in the trees. If he aimed left and had another great drive like on the last hole, the sand would be directly in his line on the second shot. If he aimed down the middle, anything could happen. His safest bet was to go down the middle and hope for a little fade or a minor slice. The fairway opened up on the right side. If he did end up hitting it straight, He'd hope it would go far enough that the sand wouldn't be a problem on his approach shot. Then he could just plunk it up on the green with his pitching wedge. He'd had good drives and bad drives today, good chips, especially in the second hole, and bad ones. His putting had been great. He looked at his ball on the tee and his club. He picked it up and laid it on his right shoulder like a baseball player waiting for the pitch. He remembered the story of Babe Ruth, pointing to where he was going to hit his home run. He tried to imagine the expression on the pitcher's face. Was he intimidated? Did he think it was a joke? But when Ruth hit the ball into the stands where he pointed, they all knew he was the best player of their time. Scott looked at a spot down the fairway. There was a lonely yellow spot on the green carpeting of the fairway. A flower, maybe a dandelion, was growing low enough to escape the mower's blade. Maybe a piece of paper or premature fall leaf. Whatever it was, it stood out against the emerald carpet of grass, and he could use it as a target. It looked approximately halfway between the 100-yard and 150-yard markers on the fairway. It was on the right side where he hoped to be, but safely away from the rough. He took his right hand and pointed at the yellow speck. "That's where I'm going to hit it, Paul," Scott said. Paul came up behind him and looked over his shoulder where he was aiming. "At that dandelion? Go for it." "Ha," blurted Andrew Patterson. He was looking down the fairway, shaking his head. "You won't get within 5 yards of that spot, Hanover." Scott let down his club and walked back to talk to Patterson. "You know, Andrew, on any given day when I might be out golfing, you'd be right. But today, on this hole, with this shot, I'll land within 1 yard of that flower out there. I don't know how I know it, but I can just feel it. It's like deja vu. I've been at this very spot with that same lonely flower sticking up in the fairway before. And I know that's where my ball will land." Scott turned to walk back to the tee. "You want to bet?" asked Andrew quietly. Scott stopped and turned. "A little side wager. Nothing big. Say $100. Scott thought about it. Did he want to lose $100 to this guy? Would he lose? The feeling he had was so strong. "I'm in for 50, Paul said. Scott grinned and walked back to Andrew. He shook his hand. 1 yard from the flower. 1 yard, Andrew agreed. Scott looked around. The red-jacketed official, who was now acting as their starter, was behaving as if he was oblivious to the wager. It was likely strictly against tournament rules, but it appeared he didn't care what the golfers did between themselves. Maybe, Scott thought, the official wanted to see Patterson lose the bet as badly as Scott wanted to take the money from him. He walked back to his ball at the tee and pointed once again. The feeling was back. He imagined that instead of on a golf course fairway, he was in a baseball stadium, and the flower was an empty seat in the right field bleachers. He warmed up by taking his practice swings like a batter would up at the plate. Then, with all seriousness, he placed his club behind the ball, looked out to the fairway, then back at the ball. He knew the shot required precision and accuracy, but most of all, luck. But he also knew, by God, he knew, it was going to land there. He pulled back and whacked the ball as hard as he dared. The white ball soared and broke to the right with a vicious slice. The people gathered at that side of the fairway parted like the Red Sea, and the ball hit the top of a tall tree with a crack that sounded at the tee a half second later. "Ha!" Patterson uttered. "Wait," Scott said. A white object bounced out from the tree line, landed on the edge of the fairway, and rolled right up to the yellow smudge on the field of green. The consolatory "ah" of the crowd was quickly replaced with cheers and applause as people realized what happened. Not exactly how Scott thought it would play out when he swung, But when he saw the ball head for the trees, he prayed for that lucky bounce.
"That's out of bounds," Andrew complained.
"Trees are in play," corrected the official.
It was plain to see the ball was well within a yard, if not 6 inches, but Andrew insisted they walk out to measure after his hit. He placed his ball on the tee with unusual shortness and proceeded to hit 5 yards beyond Scott's ball with his usual precision.
"How did you know you'd hit it there?" whispered Paul as they started to walk out.
"That was one heck of a lucky shot."
"It had to land somewhere," Scott answered.
"Why not there?"
"Man, are you some sort of witch or something? Or did you have someone standing in the woods there to throw a ball out on the fairway?"
Scott raised his eyebrows and smiled.
"That's pretty cool," Paul said. "But if you keep doing it, you're going to creep me out."
"Easy $50 for you," Scott added.
"You keep it. Put it in the kids' college fund."
"Thanks," Scott said.
"I think I will."
Sarah tried her best to hide the pain from the two women, but before she took too many steps, she was almost doubled over. They rushed in to support her, and Gina coached her.
"Breathe, Sarah, breathe. We'll have to get you to the clubhouse. This is ridiculous. I'll have our escort call in for a golf cart."
"No,"
Sarah gasped. She held up a hand and the other two waited as she slowly stood up, taking some deep breaths.
"It's over now. I'm fine between contractions, and any doctor would tell me to wait. It could be 12 hours or more before I have this kid."
"Do you want to take that risk?" Sally asked.
"It's not a risk. I want to see Scott play this out. I want to be with him at the end. If I go to the hospital now, he won't finish. I know him. He'll leave the tournament and Patterson will win. Is that what you want?"
"Cecily can have her victory," Sally said. "I don't want your baby to be in danger."
"I'm fine," Sarah argued as she started to lead the women forward. "I'll decide when it's time to go."
Gina and Sally shrugged. Sarah was probably right, and they likely had a long time before the baby would come. They'd defer to Sarah. They certainly wanted to see how things turned out as well, and both knew Scott would drop his clubs in an instant if he thought Sarah was going to have the baby now. They quickly walked to catch Sarah and lock their arms in hers, and they all three smiled.
"It's neat how Scott's ball just bounced out of the trees like that," Sarah said.
"Luckiest shot I've seen since, the last hole," Gina joked.
Their smiles turned to laughs. Andrew peeled a $100 bill off the outside of the dozen or so in his money clip and handed it to Scott, shaking his head the whole time. He walked silently back as Scott prepared for his second shot. A nice, perfect swing with his pitching wedge would put him on the green.
"Any idea where this one is going?" Paul asked.
"Haven't a clue," Scott told him.
"How about in the hole?"
"Sure. Then I'll know I'm dreaming." He took 2 practice swings and then stepped up to his ball. The tiny dandelion was 2 inches away. Scott stooped down, picked the small yellow flower, and searched the crowd. He found Sarah with Sally and Gina. He walked over to her and handed her the flower. He kissed her, and she hugged him.
"How am I doing?"
he whispered.
"I'm sorry," said Sarah. "I've been watching that guy across the way pick his nose."
They laughed.
"I think you're doing wonderful. So does the baby."
Scott looked down at her swollen belly, unaware of the contractions his future child was imposing on its mother.
"Now go and play like a good boy," she insisted.
Scott walked back to the ball and retook his practice swings to the annoyance of Andrew Patterson, and with his actual swing, placed the ball about 5 yards from the pin. The crowd applauded, and some cheered the shot. Scott turned and looked at the woods to his right. He stared at the thick-trunked oak tree that stood before him.
"Thanks,"
he called out. The tree didn't respond, but Scott forgave it. Andrew stepped up to his ball and lined up his shot. He just needed to get a little closer than Hanover. He chopped at his ball,
and it rose high and straight, bouncing 2 yards from the hole and sticking tight to the soft green. Excellent, he thought. Let's see Hanover sink his putt from 5 yards.
He's got a mixture of luck and good shots that seem to alternate with each other, pointed out Joe Calkin.
Ted Lang nodded in agreement.
It's the bell curve. He's settled far to the left of average and doesn't want to move. He's got momentum, both with his actual game and overlapped with some of the luckiest shots I've seen. I think that's the third tree he's hit. If he were a pro, he'd be nowhere near 9 under at this point. He just keeps coming back.
He just might win, Joe said.
He had seen the look on Patterson's face when he handed the money over to Hanover.
News of the side bet on the tee had spread quickly through the crowd.
Joe was relieved that the officials didn't do anything about it. He just hoped he would get to see the same expression 50 times worse after this was all over.
The boys are putting on a fine show, said Harold Frisk as they drove the cart to a position behind the 16th green.
He glanced at his portable monitor.
Look at that ball bounce out of the trees and right on the fairway. I wish my ball did that half the time I hit it into the trees. Heck, a tenth of the time.
Carl Bateman nodded in appreciation of the shot.
This is going to do a great deal for the Northern Illinois Amateur Golf Association. I'm sure we'll get membership inquiries all next week.
Give me the information. I'll make sure my commentator gets it on the air, Carl.
Really?
Sure. Wouldn't be snatching up so many viewers if it weren't for your little tournament. I'm sure we'll be able to make a contribution in support of your organization as well. My sales guy has been selling spots on the fly all afternoon.
Wonderful, cackled Carl.
He gave the information to Harold, who called it in on his cell phone. As Hanover walked up on the green, Patterson marked his ball with his giant golden dollar.
Frisk disconnected and turned the phone off before slipping it in his pocket.
Think Hanover can sink it?
No, Carl said.
Why not? The boy's hot.
Statistically, I think only 10% of putts from that far out make it in, he said.
It's still not zero.
Scott marked his ball, picked it up, wiped a green smudge, and checked it for any damage from hitting the tree. He should have done that before he hit his second shot, but fortunately it looked fine. He lined up the duck with the hole. It was a straight-in shot, no breaks or hills or slopes to deal with. Just hit it straight in.
Straight in, whispered Paul, like he was reading Scott's mind again. Only not one of those eyes-closed trance things. Seriously, it's creeping me out.
Scott chuckled and drew his club back 6 inches and tried 3 practice swings. He stepped up and repeated the swing with his ball in front of the putter. It bounced a little as it took off, and it looked like it was going in. But it was slowing too fast. It rolled closer, slowed, rolled closer, slowed, and seemed to balance on the rim of the hole. The crowd was silent and hopeful, watching and willing it to fall in. With what seemed to be a desperate effort, the ball rolled another fraction of an inch, and, like a thirsty man dragging himself to an oasis in the desert, plunked into the hole. Scott jumped in the air, waving his club like mad. Paul was jumping with him. The roar of the crowd was enormous.
10%, Frisk shouted to Bateman. Never go to Vegas, my friend.
Another birdie for Hanover, Jason screamed in the control booth.
He was jumping in place.
His headphone cord threatened to pull out of the console. I don't believe it. This guy just won't give up. If Patterson can sink his, they'll still be tied. If he misses, Hanover will be back in the lead. But no matter what, it is still anybody's game. This is just incredible. I can't remember a more exciting, nerve-wracking, suspenseful sports event in all my years on the air. Call your friends and neighbors and have them turn on their TVs. It's going to be a day to remember.
Jake Fisher punched the air and screamed,
"Yeah!"
as loud as he could,
and still he was unheard over the roar of the crowd. The excitement was thick, and people were jumping and hugging each other and shaking their heads in disbelief. As he looked around, three seemingly calm figures caught his attention. He strained his eyes a little to distinguish them from across the green, and smiled as he recognized Karen Blakely, April Weinstein, and their friend. They neither applauded nor cheered. One fellow clapped the tall, thin man on the back with a good thump that earned him a contemptuous glare for his trouble. "Yeah," Jake said again. This time he almost whispered the word. He didn't want to be too excited, but if Hanover kept this up, he just might turn out to be his ticket back into the game. It took the officials about a minute to quiet down the crowd so Andrew could attempt his putt. He knew he had the birdie, but why did Hanover have to make his? He almost didn't. Andrew was having his best game ever, and on any other day, he'd be out in the lead alone. But this miserable snot was making him fight for every stroke. He calmed himself down and lined up the putt. Straight in, 2 yards. He did these things in his sleep. He tapped the ball, and with no doubt at all, it rolled into the hole. The applause was tempered in comparison to what Hanover had received, but Hanover was the underdog. People wanted to root for the underdog, Andrew supposed. It was human nature. Still 2 holes to go, he said to himself. Anything can happen. He reached in and pulled out his ball. Scott and Paul were still grinning as they walked along the paved cart path. Ahead was the large pond. Around it circled the 17th and 18th holes. A par 3 along the water, followed by a par 4 dogleg left. The pond lined the left side of both holes, cutting into the fairways, making the last 2 holes the most challenging of the course. Scott noticed the strange rock ahead on the path. The gunning of a golf cart engine from behind startled him. He turned. The man driving the cart was busy talking to his companion. It was the same idiot who cost him a stroke at 14. Scott looked back at the path, and the strange rock lurched forward. It was a turtle, the biggest box turtle he'd ever seen. The cart was heading straight for it. He broke into a sprint and yelled, "Stop!" as loud as he could. He waved his hands like a madman. The startled man in the red jacket gripped the steering wheel with white knuckles and jammed his foot on the brake pedal, the wheels screeching over the blacktop, smoking with the friction. Scott had reached the spot where the turtle was and reached out his hands to push against the front of the cart. The cart's momentum had all but dissipated in the melting rubber of the tires, and Scott barely had to touch the cart before it stopped. "What the heck are you doing?" asked the man, soaked in sweat.
"Sorry," Scott said. "You didn't see him."
"See who?" asked the other man in the cart. Scott bent down and grabbed the turtle's shell by the edges. He lifted it up for the men to see.
"It would have made a pretty awful mess," Scott said.
"A turtle?" asked the red-jacketed official.
"Biggest box turtle I've ever seen," Scott told him.
"You almost got yourself injured over a turtle?" Carl Bateman said in disbelief.
"I wasn't thinking about getting hurt. Just didn't want the turtle to get killed," Scott answered. "I'll put him back in the water."
The turtle had started to poke his head out from its shell. It was waggling his legs, trying to twist free from Scott's grip. The crowd lining the back area of the 17th tee parted as Scott walked toward the large pond. He placed the turtle on the edge of the water, and it pushed itself into the pond, sinking slowly into the murky depths. As he stood, the nearby onlookers started to clap. Just a few at the start, then more.
"The duck saved the turtle," yelled one clever chap.
Scott smiled and waved as he hiked back up the embankment to the tee. Ellie was standing there with her camera, apparently broadcasting the whole episode to golf fans across America. Scott waved at the lens.
"Hi, Mom," he shouted.
He'd always wanted to do that. Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you are interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.